From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, Afghan president-elect vows strong unity government. Hong Kong students support democracy with a boycott. China seeks new avenues to export, including through North Korea. These stories and more in this Tuesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. Afghanistan's president-elect Ashraf Ghani gave a nationally televised speech Monday, during which he vowed to form a strong national unity government that he says will be accountable to the people, eliminate corruption, and establish peace in the war-torn country. Ayaz Ghul has more for VOA.
A day after the Afghan Election Commission declared him president of the country, Ashraf Ghani delivered his victory speech to a big gathering of political allies, supporters, and campaign workers in Kabul. He congratulated the Afghan electorate for turning the page and writing a new chapter through their vote to ensure the country's first peaceful transfer of power from one elected government to another. Ghani said those lacking understanding of this nation were skeptical about whether a peaceful democratic transfer of power would be possible, but they can see now it has happened. He urged Afghans to help him build up the nation and put the past behind them. The president-elect promised to ensure merit in every sector of the government, saying it will be a government of transparency, accountability, and there will be no room for nepotism. He said Afghanistan's stability is a priority, and he believes political problems need political solutions because conflicts cannot solve them. He added the votes Afghans have cast for him were actually votes for peace and security. The former finance minister said, "It is our strong desire and God willing, peace will be restored in Afghanistan because we are tired of conflicts." He went on to say that the word killing must be removed from our dictionaries. Ghani was named president-elect Sunday, hours after he signed a power-sharing agreement with his election rival, former Foreign Minister Abdullah Abdullah, to end months of political turmoil. Both claimed victory in the bitterly disputed June 14th presidential runoff vote that was marred by allegations of mass vote rigging. Abdullah's supporters had threatened to establish a parallel government, triggering fears of ethnic clashes like those that plagued Afghanistan in the 1990s. Under the deal, the new president will share power with the chief executive, Abdullah will propose, and the two will jointly decide who leads key financial and security institutions. Ghani dismissed criticism of the political understanding, saying the national unity government does not mean a power-sharing government. The president-elect said he, together with Abdullah, is determined to ensure implementation of election promises. It will not be a government with two heads, but a government seeking one objective, he added. The Taliban on Monday dismissed the power-sharing deal as a sham and vowed to continue their insurgency. Washington pressed Ghani and Abdullah to agree to form a national unity government to break the election deadlock. It wants the new Afghan president to sign a security pact to allow a residual American force to remain in the country after most foreign troops withdraw by the end of this year. Both Ghani and Abdullah promised in their election campaigns they would sign the agreement with the United States. Ghani will be sworn in as president by the end of this month, and the new chief executive is also expected to take oath the same day. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
A greater role for young Asian women is part of the UN General Assembly meetings this week in New York. VOA's Frances Alonso and her Women Rising series are coming up later on Daybreak Asia. Hong Kong students Monday began a week-long boycott of classes in what democracy activists hope will be the start of a campaign of civil disobedience aimed at tighter restrictions imposed by Beijing on the selection of the territory's top official, the chief executive, in 2017. The restrictions announced last month by the National People's Congress rule out open nominations for eligible voters to choose the next chief executive. Voters will have to choose among a list of candidates vetted by what critics assume will be a pro-Beijing nominating committee. Hong Kong democracy activists have called that fake democracy. Meanwhile, a new survey by the Chinese University of Hong Kong finds that 1 in 5 people questioned are considering leaving the territory over its political future. The last major exodus occurred just before Hong Kong was transferred from British to Chinese control in 1997. Willie Lam is an adjunct professor at the university's Center for Chinese Studies, and he told Daybreak Asia's Victor Beatty the new restrictions are draconian and says the one country, two systems policy toward Hong Kong has been vastly adulterated.
This has led to widespread anger and frustration. Hong Kong people realize, of course, that there's very little they can do to influence Beijing's decisions. So I think this is why more members of the middle class, professional and business classes, are planning to immigrate. So this is not a surprise.
Is the 20% figure considered high?
I think the 20% is reasonable, given the fact that this only includes one part of the block of people in Hong Kong who want to leave. I think many people think that sending the children overseas for education is enough, because they assume that their children can seek careers away from Hong Kong, whereas they themselves, people who are over 45, will remain in Hong Kong, because Hong Kong still remains a good place to make money. But for the sake of their children, most parents from middle class and professional classes, I think, want their children to have another possibility, given the fact that Hong Kong's one country, two systems, as we know it, may not survive for very long.
When the British turned the territory over to the Chinese in the late 1990s, was it the sense that they would be able to keep all of their freedoms or most of them under Chinese rule? In other words, is Beijing changing the rules of the game?
On July 1st, 1997, when the sovereignty was first turned back to China, there was a sense of euphoria in Hong Kong, because the signs are good that Beijing will keep its word. And indeed, from 1997 to middle of 2003, I think Beijing largely refrained from direct interference in Hong Kong. But the picture has changed drastically. And since Xi Jinping became General Secretary of the party in late 2012, I think Xi Jinping has put a lot more emphasis on so-called state security. That means ensuring that Hong Kong will not become a base of subversion against Beijing. So that is why Xi Jinping, of course, has 8 more years in office. So people now are generally very pessimistic about the future viability of the one country, two system model.
Is there an uptick in people leaving the territory?
According to immigration consultants and other people in this profession, there has indeed been an uptick in people applying for mostly investor category immigration to English-speaking countries, including Britain, Australia, Canada, and so forth. So I expect this trend to be exacerbated, because it is very unlikely that Beijing will show any signs of compromise regarding the electoral arrangement for 2017 in particular, and also, generally speaking, Beijing's tight control over Hong Kong will continue, and it might even get worse.
Lam says the effect of the outward migration of Hong Kong's professional class is being offset by an influx of Western-educated mainland Chinese. In the Chinese University of Hong Kong survey, more than half of those questioned said they do not trust either the Hong Kong or Beijing governments. Lam says this is because Hong Kong's government is comprised of what he calls pro-Beijing yes-men, and the Chinese Communist Party has reneged on pledges to ensure the territory's democratic traditions. He says he expects this atmosphere of pessimism to continue for the foreseeable future. Yesterday on Daybreak Asia, we reported on how a landlocked province in northeastern China is hoping to open new export routes for its trade-starved economy by offering to help a Russian company to expand a nearby Russian port on the Sea of Japan coast. Provincial authorities in Jilin made the offer in May, signing an agreement with Russian logistics company the Suma Group to cooperate in upgrading the port of Zarubino in Russia's Far East. A private Jilin company already had spent several years trying to modernize another Sea of Japan port on North Korea's coastline, but without much success. China has been seeking access to North Korean and Russian ports because of a peculiar convergence of the three nations' borders on the Tumen River, where Jilin Province is cut off from the Sea of Japan shoreline by a distance of just 15 kilometers. Daybreak Asia's Michael Lippin spoke to Carla Freeman, a China analyst at Johns Hopkins SAIS, to find out how that geographical handicap has affected China's efforts to secure trade routes there.
Since the end of the Cold War, China has been pushing hard through its provincial authorities in the region to try to develop a port along the Tumen River, actually at the delta, and dredge the river so that it would be accessible in order to give the province access to the Sea of Japan, because it is cut off from the sea and has been since actually 1860 and the Treaty of Peking, which ceded the Russian Far East to Russia. It had formerly been Chinese territory. So China has tried to find a way to ship goods out of its northeast region and has, as a result, pursued port development in North Korea, as you mentioned, in particularly the port of Rajin or Najin and Chongjin, where China has been developing wharves for a number of years. And it has also attempted to work with the countries in the region, including Russia, to develop a port facility even at the mouth of the Tumen River under the auspices of the UNDP. But this project has never received the kind of financing that it has needed to get underway. And frankly, there are a lot of questions about the impact on the environment from a project that would involve extensive dredging in a very environmentally sensitive region.
Regarding that 15-kilometer stretch of river between where Chinese territory is cut off and then the North Koreans and Russians share the rest of the river all the way up to the sea, how much traffic actually happens on that river? Do vessels go back and forth carrying goods? Is this something that China would be able to do?
Well, the Tumen really isn't a navigable river. The only part of the river that is navigable is at the mouth of the river, and even that is not terribly navigable. The conditions really have to be right. So in order to make the river a conduit for trade, it would require extensive dredging and other infrastructure development along the river. China's main port in the northeast is Dalian, of course, in Liaoning, and also Dandong on the Yalu River is another river port that China uses. But the main port facility for the region is Dalian, which is considerably south. So for the provinces of Jilin and Heilongjiang, Jilin borders both Russia and North Korea. Heilongjiang shares a long border with Russia. For those two provinces to move goods both to other parts of China and to the rest of Asia is very difficult. And I think what is really happening here is that this is an opportunity for China to expand port access. There's a rail line between Zarubino and a border port in Jilin. And so there's a rail line that can help move goods to Zarubino. And there's even some talk of expanding or extending the Trans-Siberian rail line to Zarubino, which then would enable perhaps that port to become, you could move goods from other parts of Asia and from other parts of China to Zarubino, and then that could be another conduit for goods moving across Eurasia to European markets. So that's, I think, why the Russian investor that is leading the development of Zarubino is excited about this port. That particular company is a major player in ports in Europe, and I think it sees possibilities in developing Zarubino.
Carla Freeman, Associate Director of the China Studies Program at Johns Hopkins SAIS here in Washington, speaking with Michael Lippin. Networks of fishing communities from Cambodia and Thailand are banding together to try to halt hydropower dam construction along the Mekong River. Community leaders and environmentalists warn disrupting the water flow and fish migration will impact millions of lives in the lower Mekong region, and they are now working together to try to convince governments to abandon the projects. Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok.
The campaign by the networks brought together local fishing communities from Thailand and Cambodia, who collectively fear the potential loss of livelihoods from the damming of waters along the lower reaches of the 4,300-kilometre Mekong River. Millions of people in Cambodia and Thailand directly depend on access to fish for food security. The fishing community networks say they oppose all large-scale hydropower dams in the Mekong Basin. Up to 11 hydropower dams are planned on the lower Mekong. After years pressing their cases against individual dams, they are now trying to join forces and lobby each government in the region. Om Savat is Executive Director of the Cambodia-based Fisheries Action Coalition Team, FACT.
We try to push the government, especially the Cambodia government and another country, to be study or to be stop that dam for the along the Mekong River, especially Don Sahong, because near border Cambodia and Laos, and this really a lot of effect to the fisheries sector. We are joining together, especially from Cambodian network, Thailand, Laos and Vietnam, and we plan to connect to Myanmar.
The networks called for Laos to halt construction of the $3.5 billion Xayaburi Dam in northern Laos and stop the planned 260-megawatt Don Saong Dam near the borders of Cambodia and Thailand. Scientists say the Don Saong Dam would impact vital fish migration. The area is considered to be the only secure fish passage during the region's dry season. Premridi Daurung, co-director of the Non-Government Foundation for Ecological Recovery, says local communities need to have a say in the future, as any development will directly affect their livelihoods.
The people need to have more voice directly. You know, people who are going to be directly affected, you know, get the impact from the dam. You know, I mean, in the movement on the hydropower dam in Mekong now, there are many groups involved. And we have to admit that the two countries that have a strongest voice, I mean, in terms of the local people, are Thailand and Cambodia.
Dam construction on the lower Mekong in Laos impacts Thailand, where several rivers are tributaries of the Mekong mainstream. In northeastern Thailand's Ubon Ratchathani province, the Pakmun River communities have fought for almost 30 years against a dam and later to ensure floodgates are regularly open to allow fish access from the Mekong. Leader of the Pakmun River community, Sompong Vieng Chan, says a dam at Don Saong would have a major impact on fish stocks and lives in the local community.
I can say very clearly that any dam that built on the river, like Moon River, really cut us from our own rivers. And this is going to be the same about Mekong as well. Mekong is the river of us all. When you build the dam upstream or the downstream will have problem. If you build the dam downstream, the upstream people of Mekong will get the impact. If you build Don Sahong Dam, if the Don Sahong Dam really happen, the Moon people, Pak Moon people cannot live as well. It will immediately affect us.
In Cambodia, up to 6 million people are directly dependent on fish for food security from the Great Lake or Tonle Sap. The leader of the Tonle Sap Fisher Network, Lung So Chet, says those communities fear the future if the Don Sahong Dam goes ahead. Long So Chet says to block the water from the Mekong would cause fishing stocks to fall rapidly, leading to the suffering of local people due to the loss of livelihood and the impact on the natural resources. A study by the intergovernmental body, the Mekong River Commission, MRC, which brings together Laos, Thailand, Cambodia and Vietnam, has warned damming the lower Mekong could reduce fish stocks by up to 300,000 metric tons a year, hitting hard communities in Cambodia. In Phnom Penh in early September, activists rallied against Malaysian-based investors backing the Don Sahong Dam project, with some 250,000 signatures and identities pressing for a suspension of the project. Vietnam has taken a strong stand on the projects. In April, at a summit of Mekong leaders, Vietnam called for a 10-year moratorium on all damming construction on the Mekong mainstream. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
If you happen to be listening live and have missed some of our program, no problem. Just download the podcast of today's and even previous editions of Daybreak Asia at voanews.com. As heads of state gather in New York this week for their annual 2014 UN General Assembly, girl leaders and their advocates are calling for adolescent girls to be a central part of the post-2015 Millennium Development Goals, or MDGs. Suzanne Petroni is the Senior Director of Gender, Population, and Development with the International Center for Research on Women. She tells Daybreak Asia's Francis Alonso that young women from Asia have participated in a girl declaration to urge world leaders to ensure the problems they face around the world are addressed and are included in world poverty reduction efforts.
We know from significant research and evidence that when girls are empowered, the health and the economic well-being of entire countries really can improve. But we also know that the first round of Millennium Development Goals, the MDGs, really made no mention of girls or the challenges that they face or their potential to contribute to development. And as a result, the needs and the assets of millions of girls who are living in poverty around the world really have been ignored over the past 15 years. Far too many girls now remain vulnerable to abuse, to exploitation, forced in early marriage, early and unwanted pregnancy, trafficking, malnutrition, and a host of other challenges. So as policymakers are coming together this week at the UN to discuss the follow-on to the MDGs, which will expire next year, we really have an unprecedented opportunity to ensure that girls are central to these efforts.
Please explain the Girl Declaration.
Yeah, the Girl Declaration is a call to action from girls and from allies of girls around the world. It urges world leaders to put adolescent girls at the heart of the global development agenda. The declaration contains the recommendations and priorities of more than 500 girls living in poverty around the world. And it really gives girls the opportunity and the ability to raise their concerns and their voices to ensure that the issues that they face and the challenges that confront them each and every day will be addressed by global leaders. Girls from 14 countries were interviewed and asked to contribute to this declaration. And Asia actually played quite a significant role. So there were girls from China, India, Indonesia, Pakistan, and the Philippines. And this is really important because there are such a range of issues facing girls across this region. South and East Asia, for example, has the highest rates of suicide among adolescent girls aged 15 to 19 in the world, five times higher than Europe or the Americas. But the fact that suicide has now replaced maternal mortality as the leading cause of death for adolescent girls globally is a real concern. It's pretty shocking just how prevalent it is across South and East Asia. We know that child marriage is a huge concern in this region of the world as well, the greatest numbers, of course, being in South Asia. So the opportunity for girls to express their desires for a different world for themselves was really critical. Simply put, when girls are able to grow up healthy and educated and empowered, they're better poised and better able to not only ensure their own success and well-being, but also to contribute to the development of their communities and countries. And that really is essential in order to alleviate poverty. So as the global community looks toward the post-2015 development agenda that will follow on the Millennium Development Goals, their concerns and their issues really need to be central to the discussion.
Suzanne Petroni is the Senior Director of Gender, Population, and Development with the International Center for Research on Women. She spoke with Daybreak Asia's Francis Alonso, and be sure to hear her reports each week on her Women Rising series. Stay right where you are, and you can hear the latest world news. It's next with Steve Norman and International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
For listeners in China, there's a new Chinese language iPhone application from VOA. Simply go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA
Face Chinese, and then look for VOA News Chinese Edition. With this application, you can get the latest news and radio and TV programs in Chinese. It also lets you transfer photos and video directly to Washington. Go to the iTunes App Store and type VOA Space Chinese to get your free Chinese language iPhone app from VOA.